Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Good evening. Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for June the 24th, 2019. This is David Corey, along with my co-host Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. We have several major segments in our show tonight, including a special guest, and we'll also have news and other interest items of interest for veterans and their families. As you may recall, the month of June is PTSD Awareness Month. So with that in mind, let me turn it over to Richard Hurley. Hello, Richard.
Hey, David, and thank you very much, and good evening, everybody. Yes, tonight we have a very special guest, Mr. Dave Johnson, who's a Vietnam veteran. And before I introduce Mr. Johnson to the show, I want to remind everybody that this is a call-in show. That means you can pick up the phone and give us a ring and tell us what's on your mind. As we go through the evening, you may even want to call and talk to Mr. Johnson or tell us something else about your own situation. As David said, this is PTSD Awareness Month, and so we're going to be focusing on that, and that's one of the reasons that Mr. Johnson's on the show tonight. So without any further delay, Doug, please welcome Mr. Johnson onto the show. Dave?
Yes.
How are you tonight?
I'm fine, thank you very much.
And thank you for joining us to be on the Veterans News Hour.
My pleasure.
You know, when you and I first talked, I thought you had such an interesting story, which we're going to get to regarding that TV show, and then your own personal story in Cambodia and everything that happened to you. And before we get to those events, please tell our audience a little bit about your service.
Well, I entered the service in June of 1963 when I graduated from the University of Illinois through. And I was commissioned through an ROTC program there. So when I came in the Army, I was a second lieutenant. And after I went to Fort Benning for infantry officer training and airborne training, I was assigned to the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, where I was a platoon leader for a year or so, and later a battalion adjutant. I worked in an airborne infantry battalion there for my first assignment.
And then
after I was there about a year and a half, or maybe 2 years, we were deployed. We didn't call it that, but we were deployed to Vietnam as a unit. Our brigade went, which was numbered about 3,500 people. And we went over on a ship and took about 23 days to get to Vietnam. But shortly after we arrived in Vietnam, we began combat operations once we got acclimated, and these operations were normally patrols and search and destroy operations and security. Our first, I think our first casualty there was a guy from Alaska who stepped on what we referred to as a bouncing Betty, which is a mine. When you stepped on it, when the person stepped on it, it was a small explosion that sent a device up about 3 feet right between your legs, and that's where the charge blew off. So we lost that first guy to that kind of a mine, kind of a demoralizing thing, not only for the unit, but for all of us that knew him. And
now, Dave,
I lost a good friend. What's that?
How soon after you arrived in Vietnam
that was about 6 weeks, maybe a month after we arrived. We were up in a place called the An Ke Pass, providing security where the 1st Cav Division came in. And now I wasn't with that young man when he got killed, but I was, of course, aware of it. We all knew about it. And that was sort of a wake-up call, I guess you could say. We're in the real thing here. They want to do us some harm. But that was what the whole thing was about. Anyway, the year progressed. We had a pretty serious battle in September where 13 of our men were killed and about 27 wounded at a little place called An Inn. And the battalion made an insertion there, but I think the enemy was ready for them when they got there. I didn't make the insertion. I have to make that clear. But I was helpful in bringing the people back after they'd been killed. And my most vivid memory of that, I had two really good friends killed that day, and they were in body bags, but they were sort of stacked in the back of a deuce and a half so they could be taken down to the grave registration place in Quignon, I think it was. And that was a pretty, vivid day. And that picture of those guys has stayed with me a long time. Another bad thing that happened that day, one of my friends was a captain who was killed, and his body was dragged back, and a photographer was there from the AP, took a picture of the man, not from the front, you couldn't see his face in the photo that was published, but you, from the back, if you knew the guy, you could tell exactly who he was. Now, I'm not sure this happened, but we were told that that picture was published in the paper in Tennessee, where his wife lived, and allegedly, she saw that picture before she was notified, and when we found out about that, that's pretty sorry, you know, something like that would happen. But I think after we we left there, we moved around all over the place in Vietnam, and other actions occurred. I remember going through an area down around the Michelin rubber plantation one day, and I was a company XO then, or, you know, and one of the troops yelled at me, "Lieutenant, stop." And I just stepped over a wire on a booby trap connected to a grenade, and I think if I'd taken another step, I'd have probably, you know, done a job on myself, and the two guys were pretty close to me. But later, maybe the day later or so, our point squad got ambushed, and we were moving along through some jungle. A firefight ensued. We lost a guy, a squad leader, and two or three others wounded. It was a pretty crowded, a lot of trees around, so we had to enlarge our area where we could bring the helicopter in for a medevac and to get the squad leader's body out. So we were chopping trees and stuff and trying to enlarge it. And I felt, I was kind of directing traffic there, and I looked down and I felt something bump against my boot. And I looked down and it was the head of a VC that had been chopped off and rolled across the clearing. I told the guy to take it and bury it right away. And we had important stuff to do. We had to get that helicopter in, but that's kind of vivid, you know, in my mind.
Yeah.
Apparently the guy that did it was really overcome with emotion when he saw his squad leader get hit so bad, and the head was cut off after the enemy was dead. But still, you know, kind of vivid.
Yeah. Wow. Now, I know you had quite a story up in Cambodia.
Well, I was on my third tour. My second tour.
Now,
before
you get to it's clear to everybody, you're now on your third tour in Vietnam, and you know David's probably more familiar with this than I am, because you know I've been representing veterans now for 7 years, and I'd say in 7 years I've had one or two veterans who did two tours, and they were special intel people, but you actually did three tours.
Yeah, I had 2 years between each tour. So I did one in 68 as a rifle company commander. That's when I got wounded. And I was only there 6 months because I got evacuated. But my third tour began in December 1971. And I was, again, in an infantry assignment. This time, though, I was an advisor with an infantry, Vietnamese infantry regiment. You there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Well, I'll fast forward. I lived with the Vietnamese. We rode in the helicopters with them, and my responsibility primarily was to assist in the coordination of U.S. assets, either helicopter assets or fire support or artillery, or whatever they needed. We were trying to facilitate it and bring it in for them. So I didn't spend a lot of time on the ground, but a lot of time in helicopters, looking over operations, making insertions, calling for fires, things like that. But it was in July, on July 5th of 72, that I was told to get in a slick helicopter and go make a recon up in Cambodia, because we were getting quite a bit of fire. We were at our base right next to Cambodia, like 3 or 4 miles from Cambodia. And we were getting 120-millimeter fire and rockets and stuff coming from Cambodia. So our Vietnamese counterparts wanted me to go up and do a recon to see if there were some targets up there that they could engage. And so we got in the slick. It was just the crew of four, the pilot, co-pilot, and the door gunners, and another officer and myself. We started up and got up about as maybe 40 miles into Cambodia, where Highway 1 runs between Saigon and Phnom Penh. And we turned left, and just as we made a left, we're about 2,000 feet in the air, and a smoke trail went right beside the helicopter. I was sitting looking out the door. I thought it went between my legs, but it's probably 100 or 200 feet away. I don't know. Things get magnified, though, when they're scary.
Sure.
And so we made it. The pilot saw it, too, and I said, "What's that?" And he said, "That's a SA-7 heat-seeking missile." And so we made a turn, headed back toward Vietnam. Second one was fired at us. But by this time, though, the helicopter was making evasive actions, and we were decreasing in altitude to try to stay away from the missiles. And we got down to about 1,500 feet, and I heard a thunk hit the side of the helicopter, and probably 51 caliber fire. Anyway, it hit our hydraulic system, and the helicopter lost power. The pilot was able to bring us in on the ground, though, through, I guess you'd call it, a rotation, where the blades keep turning even though the engine's not operating properly. So on our way down, we knew we were going to crash. So on our way down, he called a mayday, and I had a radio with me, hand-carried radio, and I also called a mayday. And so my headquarters back there would know we were going down. As soon as we landed, we had a real hard landing, not a crash, and nobody got hurt, but we all scrambled out of the helicopter, and right away, we start coming under fire, small arms and machine gun fire. And we were in a huge open area. I'd never seen a place in Vietnam that had just no cover, no concealment, no rice paddy dikes, no grass. We're just like out on a big field, maybe 400 meters across. And within about 2 or 3 minutes, we couldn't get the machine guns off the helicopter, so all we had were a couple M16s and some 45 pistols and not very much ammo. Well, we didn't expect it being a firefight that day. But about 3 or 4 minutes after we landed on the ground, and after we called our mayday, I heard this radio transmission, and it says, "This is Hill Climber 3-2. We're a Chinook, and we're en route to pick you up." I thought, yes, well, that was really a relief just to hear that somebody was heading in our direction. And the pilot of that helicopter was Bruce Grable. Mm. And they were about 20 miles, 30 miles south of us, and they were empty. They had hauled some ammunition out to a fire base, and they were going back to get another load. So they didn't have anything on board. I told the pilot, and I said, "Well, when you come in, you got to come in from the south and head back out of the south right away, because we're under fire from the west and the north and the east." And he just said, "Roger that." So when I saw him coming up over the tree line, that was really a great feeling. I said, "Here he's actually here. He's faster than I thought." But I got to meet the crew chief or the aircraft, the engineer on that is a sergeant, 3 or 4 years ago, and through a mutual friend. Anyway, he said that he was coming in that day, and all the fire that's being directed at us, the tracer, the machine gun, and all that, now is going to be at the helicopter, much more lucrative target. The Chinook is like a bus coming in, slow. Well, not slow, but it's a good target. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he told himself that day, he said, today is the day I'm going to die. We're not going to get out of this alive. But they came on in, and they spun the helicopter around in a real fast 180 and presented the ramp toward our position. And, of course, as soon as they got the ramps down, we're racing on board. Rounds are kicking up all around us and hitting into the helicopter. We got on board, and they took off, and one of the engines was damaged by the fire. So they didn't have full power. So once again, this crew chief told me years later, he said, when we came out, he said, I thought we were going to crash in a tree line because we were just limping out of there. But he said, I felt as if the hands of God were around that helicopter bringing us out to safety. It was, I'd say, close to miraculous. Nobody got hit in all this thing. None of us got even scratched with a round. So I think the Lord was looking after us that day. We got back to the fire base, though. He put the helicopter, landed on our little airstrip, and I didn't see the pilot. I'm sure I got up and thanked him, but I had to get back to the operations center real fast, and I never saw him again. But I did take the time to write up a recommendation for an award for him and for the Distinguished Flying Cross, and I hoped he and maybe the members of his crew would be recognized. And my boss didn't have the authority to make that award, but I thought maybe his aviation brigade guys could do it for him. So I sent the, well, I guess you'd call it a witness statement, sent it in and a recommendation, but I never knew what happened to it. And I never saw him again because, you know, I went home in about 5 months, and we weren't assigned to the same place. But for many years, I thought, I'd really like to see that guy again and properly thank him for what he did. And so I wrote a couple letters to where I thought he might be, but I never got a response. This is before we had Googles and Facebooks and all that stuff. And I'm not very good at that anyway. But about 18 months ago, my wife Judy and I were watching a show on TV called We'll Meet Again, where Ann Curry and her staff on PBS would reunite people that had been in some kind of a interesting or traumatic experience together many years ago, but hadn't had any contact in the meantime. And at the end of the show, there's a little trailer or something that said, if you have a story you'd like us to consider, why, send us an email. So Judy said, why don't you write that up, Dave? Why don't you tell them about your story in being picked up in Cambodia? So I did, and like a day later, I got an email back from England, where the production company was, and they said, we're very interested in your story. We'd like to talk to you on the phone about it. So we did, and kind of one thing led to another. And about a couple months later, we were sent up to Washington, D.C. for an interview with Ann Curry. And it was in a townhouse, you know, they had a room set up with cameras and lights and reflectors and microphones, all that, you know. And she's a very gracious lady, and she and I sat down, and she said, David, are you just a little bit nervous about doing this interview? And I said, no, Ann, I'm not a little bit nervous. I'm a whole lot nervous because I've never been interviewed on a TV or anything like that. So, but she said, well, let's just pretend this is a conversation. So she's very helpful and led me through the story. And then we went through a couple guys came back down to Florida with us, a photographer, video guy, and a producer. And then they led me and my wife through a series of places where they had already found out information about this pilot. And they kind of pieced it together as we went along. Oh, up at Fort Rucker, Alabama, at the Army Aviation Museum, and then up at Montgomery, Alabama, where we met a guy who's a Vietnam Helicopter Association official. And then finally they said, okay, we found Bruce Grable. We know where he lives, and you're going to meet him in Atlanta. So then we drove to Atlanta, and they took me to this park where they already had Bruce set up there. And that's where we got to meet. Very emotional. And, you know, I had a picture of my family, at our 50th wedding anniversary. My wife, of course, our son, and our daughter and her husband and three grandchildren and my sister, anyway, and her family. But I showed Bruce a picture. I said, you know, Bruce, if you hadn't saved my life, you know, this family wouldn't look like this. You know, we wouldn't have been there. And we had a he brought along with him the Distinguished Flying Cross that he'd been awarded. I was so happy
wow.
to learn that that award that I had recommended for him was approved, and that he said, you know, Dave, this award and a Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry that my division Vietnamese counterparts recommended for him. He said, these are the only two things that have to do with the Army that I have displayed in my home. And I really felt good about that because I thought, wow, at least I was able to get him some recognition for the thing, for what he did. Because, you see, nobody ordered Bruce Grable to come pick me up. Nobody even suggested that he come or said, hey, oh, by the way, would you like to go up and get these guys? He did this on his own. And
he heard your radio.
Yeah, he heard the Mayday, and they talked to the crew. You know, he said, hey, we got six guys down up in Cambodia. Nobody's available around here, apparently, that can get them right away. They're under fire. What do you think? And I believe all the crew said, yeah, let's go. If we were there, we'd want to be picked up. But that was a tremendous thing he did. And I told Ann Curry, I said, you know, this is not so much about me. I was just a passenger on two helicopters that day. One got shot down and one picked me up. The real hero or heroes in this story are Bruce Grable and his crew. And throughout all this, what I've tried to do is honor them and recognize them. Now, having said that, I must be quick to also note that this is just one rescue in a war that lasted like 10 years. There are probably hundreds, maybe thousands of rescues. I know a lot of medevacs that took place under fire. And I don't want to make this sound like it was the most horrendous, you know, situation that anybody ever faced, because it's not at all. And nobody got hurt. And I don't want to diminish what other people experienced or what they were involved with by making a big deal about this story. But it's kind of like my story, and so that's the one I get to tell.
Well,
and I know there are other stories out there.
There's a lot of stories, Dave, but this is your story, and it is a big deal. I mean, Bruce Grable, his part in your story, and like you said before, you know, showing him the pictures of your family, you know, his heroics made all of that possible for you,
yeah.
your wife, your children, your grandchildren. And, you know, it's nice on a show like this, the Veterans News Hour, for our listeners to actually hear these stories. I mean, you know, I think too often we might read about them or you see a movie, you know, and Hollywood gets involved and they really make these dramatic things. And, you know, like you just said, you know, no one got hurt. Now, if this was a Hollywood story, they'd probably throw in some wounded or something. I mean, you're just telling the basic story. But the bottom line is, you know, this gentleman, Mr. Grable, here's your Mayday. And on his own, brother helping brother, he goes out
That's
there
right.
and rescues you and your guys. I mean, how, you know, just to give a, if he didn't show up, I mean, there must have been something in your mind, like, you know, you knew he was coming, but there was a moment before you knew he was coming that you were probably wondering, how long will it be before someone comes and rescues us, and if they will rescue us? I mean, how much time do you think you had?
Well, we didn't have much time. In fact, I told Bruce, I said, if you hadn't come in, we'd either been captured or killed, because there's no way we could have gotten out of that open area without them getting us. They were practically not surrounding us, but very close. And we had limited ammunition, and we were finished if he hadn't come in. And I think it's hard to say how many minutes or we could have lasted there, but it wouldn't have been long. So he was like the he was it. You know.
So I know you recently made a trip out to Fort Drum, and you had an opportunity to tell this story again. Please tell our audience about that, because that's also a great part of your story.
Well, a few months ago, I got a, I guess, an email or call or something from a person at Fort Drum that's involved with their activities, ceremonies, whatever. And they said they were having like a special event day, which was last Thursday and Friday. They were going to have some troop demonstrations. They were going to bring the 50 flags of the states, the United States, out, fire some howitzers to recognize each state. We had the colors there. We had some people dressed up in World War II 10th Mountain Division white uniforms, you know, and had the skis on their back like they did. And it was a big deal, certainly for us, and I think for them, too. The commanding general of the division was there, his staff, and a lot of the other commanders. And they asked Bruce and me to come up there as their guests of honor. So, wow, that was quite a special honor for both of us. And we were escorted around the post, and we were taken to the aviation brigade, where they had a couple of Chinooks in the big hangar there that they were working on, and they had it all set up so Bruce and I could get on board the Chinook, and he got to sit up in the pilot's seat in the cockpit and went over the controls and discussed the brand-new Chinooks that they have now, which were, you know, more powerful and more sophisticated electronically than the one he was flying. But he got a big kick out of that, I know. And I got to talk to some soldiers that were there. We were interviewed, and I think they showed a little clip on their local news there. And the next day, they had the ceremony, and we were invited to be the guest speakers there. So the general got up and gave a brief synopsis of our, you know, what happened with us. And then each, Bruce and I were each invited to come up and make a few remarks. So here again, I was able to recognize Bruce for what he did and, you know, thank him publicly there in front of some guys that are, you know, on active duty right now, almost all of them. There were some people from the town there. But it was a really special day, and he and his wife and Judy and I got to spend a little more time together, and it was, for an old soldier, it was really a special day. You know, I've been retired longer than the age of most of those troops that I was talking to. So I'm really an old man, but I have a, you know, I only spent 26 years in the Army, but I got a lot of great memories, and to be able to go up there and kind of mingle and talk with those guys, and they were nice enough to spend some time with me, and it was a very special day.
That's great. I know we're going to talk a little bit about PTSD. As you know, June is post-traumatic stress disorder awareness month, as announced by the VA. And one of the reasons I have you on the show this month is to talk a little bit about PTSD. You in our pre-interview, you were talking about a young man that you met. That and you really had an opinion about this, about how disturbing it was for you to hear that he had just been deployed, he came back, and then he had to ship out again. And you and I were going to talk more about that type of deployment. But share with us a little bit about that young man that you were talking to me about.
Well, he wasn't a young man. He'd been in the Army for several years. I don't know how long, but he'd. When I asked him how many times he'd been deployed, he had to think for a minute. It was like I can tell you about three times in Vietnam, you know. But he said, I think it was like 10 or 12 times. Now, not every one of them was a full year, I'm sure. Some of them were shorter periods of time. Some of those guys, I guess, are deployed for 3 or 4 months, maybe 9 months. But I do know that I just finished reading a book called Outlaw Platoon about this platoon from the 10th Mountain Division that was there, completed a whole year of duty over near the Pakistan border, and was in some really, you know, terrific stuff. And then they got extended for 4 months or 3 months. So they had to spend, you know, well past their year. So I don't know. When I look back on my career, my time in combat, I would go there for a year. Then I had 2 years back in the States to kind of get myself together and have time with my family and, you know, produce a couple kids. But I really don't know how these guys handle it with these multiple deployments and back and forth with sometimes very short periods of time at home with their families. It just must be very tough. I can't really appreciate that because that wasn't the situation I faced. So I have a lot of empathy for them.
You know, I was telling you, I know in Canada, for instance, when a soldier returns from a deployment, he is required to be home at a minimum of 6 months. And during this time, it's required of him, and this is part of his duty now that he's home, to spend time with the family. He's got kids, spend time with the kids, go coach them, go do all the things that a father is supposed to be doing. In addition to that, if he was subjected to some sort of traumatic stress, he should seek whatever psychological counseling would be available to him. But you know, there was an obvious recognition by the Canadian government, military, that those soldiers who are subjected to traumatic events need some time to just. Get over it a little bit, like you said, you know, get back into more of a normal routine. Obviously, that's not happening today. If someone is going 10 or 13 times, they're not really getting that kind of time to take care of themselves.
Well, I think it puts a lot of pressure on them. And I don't know, I'm not on active duty now, and I can't say what the Army's doing. I'm sure I know they have programs to try to, you know, help the families when the people are overseas and help them out when they come home. But I'd like to point out to you, too, that when I was in Vietnam, I never heard the word post-traumatic stress. And I don't know when that came about, but we never talked about that. And I know of just a few guys that I can remember who exhibited some serious stress, even while they were still on active duty. But it wasn't something you talked about. And in my case, the traumatic events that I witnessed, and again, I'm not trying to make them sound like the guy that did it all, because I didn't. But I would never have admitted to my commander, even to a physician. I never saw a shrink. If I went to you wouldn't go to a psychiatrist if you were in a career Army like I was, because it would have been like the kiss of death. If you admitted that you couldn't handle it or that you were having trouble handling it, I just think that you'd be looked down upon probably. At least that was my perception. And I would never have admitted to anybody that I was having a problem I was dealing with. And I don't know when this started, when they started recognizing it, which I think is a good thing. But back then, you wouldn't have sought help. Well, I wouldn't have. I'll speak for myself.
Mm-hmm. David and I deal a lot with post-traumatic stress, and, you know, I'm getting new cases all the time, Vietnam veterans, and, you know, I'll sit in the office and we'll go through the physical disabilities, and then I'll kind of casually say, now, you know, don't take offense to this, but I've got to ask the question, do you have any mental issues that we need to discuss and maybe file a claim for with the VA, and whether it's anxiety or depression, and then I'll casually mention post-traumatic stress. And, you know, the reaction's always different, you know, especially with the Marines. But the Marines right away say, no, I'm fine. And then when you start talking to them more and more, all of a sudden it starts to come out, and the wife, a lot of times the wife will sit there and say, you know, I've never heard these stories before. He hasn't said it. We've been married 30 some odd years, and this is the first I'm hearing about what happened to him in Vietnam. And then, you know, we start talking about the different symptoms that are associated with PTS. And the wife will go, oh, my God, he's got all those. But the veteran is holding back and resisting. And then, before, you know, the longer I talk to him, the longer he recognizes that, yeah, this is something he's got to deal with. So.
Well, I think in my case, if I had that, or what you're describing, over the years, I've just tried to push it back, to suppress it, to, you know, not think about it maybe, but some things you can't not think about is you're not going to verbalize about them, you're not going to talk to other people about them, but you, you have to keep going on, you have to cope with it, but... again, I'm not trained in psychology.
No, I know you're not. But let me ask you a question. Were you able to share your Vietnam experience with your wife?
Not entirely, but yeah. I did talk to her. she was married. We were married before I went on my first tour, and she handled everything while I was gone. And she's another hero in the story because the second time when I went. And I got wounded. I didn't tell her even that I got wounded until I got to Japan where I had an operation. And I thought, well, I can let her know now. I told her I was coming home. But when I got orders to go the third time, she said to herself, I think, she said, well, they're going to kill him this time because it was he got through the first tour fine and he got wounded the second. And... so it was, she endured a lot. I'll tell you, you know, she got a lot of abuse, particularly on that second time I was gone too, ridicule, you know, because her husband's in the Army. And so I think wives had to put up with a lot of crap back then just because they were married to a soldier and people hated the war and the guys in uniform and their spouses were very visible targets for their anger and their ridicule, and she had to put up with a lot of that. And so I give her a lot of credit for raising our family, taking care of everything when I'm gone. See, we couldn't talk to each other. We didn't have email or phone, you know, iPhones or anything like that. We just had to write letters. But bless her heart, she never complained. She never wrote to me that anything was going wrong or having a trouble with a car or anything like that. It's always upbeat letters, and so I was able, though, eventually to pretty much tell her everything. And about 2 years ago, she asked me to write down like a little book about my experiences in Vietnam, so our grandchildren would have something they could look at and say, "Okay, that's what the old man did." So I started writing, and after I'd write a chapter, you know, recalling these things, and she would read it, to proofread it, and she's, you know, I got some. Things were going on in my life at that time. I said, well, write them down. So she did. And so the book we finally put together was a combination of our thoughts and recollections. And we didn't publish the book. We just printed it so that our kids could have a copy. And I think for me that was a good thing because I could spill it all out there and put it on paper and some pictures in there, and I don't want to say I got a closure. I don't know what that word means, but it was a good thing, I think, to do. And I think my children, my grandchildren really appreciated it, too.
You know, one of the things that David and I do when we have when we're representing a veteran is we ask them to give us a written statement about their service. Yeah, I used to do these day-in-the-life type of stories.
Right.
And I used to get that comment from the veteran. At first, they were like, oh, I don't want to do that. You know, you could tell that they were going to be agonizing through it. And then with my help, we could kind of get them through it. And then when it's finally done and he signs off on it, I used to get a lot of comments like, you know, that was one of the best things I've done for myself.
Yeah. I think for me, I think it was a little, in a way, it was therapeutic, you know, to go ahead and put all that in chronological order and remember all those things. And the other thing it helped me do was remember the names and the instances where I lost friends And I carry today in my Bible and in my billfold 16 names of guys I knew pretty well and friends of mine that were killed over there. And I think it's important that I remember and reflect on them.
If there are any veterans listening to our show tonight, you know, this might be good for you as well. You haven't done so already, to sit down and write your story for yourself, especially if you're in the process of filing a claim with the VA, or whether it's a physical or a mental claim, because, you know, part of the evidence that the VA has to recognize are buddy statements. So if you're able to kind of write your story out and all of a sudden these names start popping up, maybe you can reach out to some of these people and they can corroborate your story, because unfortunately the VA doesn't necessarily rely just on the veteran's statement, and they're, you know, they're looking for some supporting or corroborating evidence. So that's a very good tip there, Dave. Really good tip.
Well, I think, too, there are probably a lot of guys like me that would never have stepped into a psychiatrist's office unless we were ordered to. You know, I would never have done that.
Yeah, that's... Well, I'm ordering you to.
Okay. Yeah.
Well...
Listen, I appreciate your interest in my story and in my situation. It's good to have somebody listen to you. Thank you for that.
Dave, I want to thank you for your service, for your time on the Veterans News Hour and everything that you were able to share with us and our audience. It was a terrific show having you on, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate what you do, but for guys that have been hurt, in particular those that have had, you know, mental issues and emotional issues like this, sometimes they're as hard to deal with, I'm sure, as if you had lost your foot or something, you know, or worse. So thanks a lot, Richard, for what you and your partners there do. We appreciate it a lot.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Have a good evening.
God bless you both.
Thank you. You too.
All right, David. Well, I'm going to turn it over to you now.
Well, thanks again to our special guest, Dave Johnson, for sharing his story, and thank him. We thank him for his service, 26 years in the Army, including 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, and the sacrifices he went through, and his family as well. We certainly appreciate that, and thank him for sharing his experiences with us tonight. I think it helps all of us to hear directly from a veteran, especially a combat veteran, on you know, the effects of war, the loss of buddies in war, and the toll it can take. And it's also interesting. I found it interesting as he was making the comparison between his 3 tours of duty in Vietnam, which spanned from early days of the war towards the latter days of the war, and comparing that when he said that he would have a couple years back home between being sent back to Vietnam, and then comparing that to the current generation of soldiers that might, you know, since 2001 have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan many times, sometimes for shorter than 1 year tours, but back and forth with very little time at home. And that probably also explains why so far over 1 million veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars have already filed disability claims with the VA. And Rick, I know our experience in helping veterans in our work that we've represented many from those wars, excuse me. And again, since, you know, the focus this month is post-traumatic stress awareness, that we've represented many veterans that have really suffered because of their experience. And I certainly can understand what Dave Johnson said about it really rings true from my own experience in the military, although I certainly wasn't ever in combat, but it certainly rings true with everything I perceived when I was in the service, which was, bottom line, is that, most people are extremely reluctant to say, okay, I need help, I'm going to go see a psychologist or psychiatrist. And as he mentioned, as an officer, it would be practically a career-ending kind of a move to do that. And it just never happened back then, and even probably just in recent years where there's more awareness of it, there's maybe that reluctance maybe has dropped a bit. But I'd say still there is that that mindset, that culture of not ever displaying weakness. I mean, displaying weakness is totally contrary to what you have to do to be successful in the military to begin with. So I think that explains a lot of it. And as he was describing, Rick, when you ask him, about his own personal experience and how he coped with it, that he, a lot of it is just kind of blocking it out. But you can't avoid thinking of some things, but basically just kind of coping on your own. And I think that we see that, Rick, with a lot of the veterans we help, that how they cope in their own ways, often not very effectively, at least the ones that we meet and try to help. But on a positive note, the VA has made great strides in recent decades. As Dave Johnson said, back in Vietnam, they didn't use the word post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress disorder. I know the concept was, people are aware of that because prior wars, World War II, maybe they called it shell shock. World War I had a different name for it. But certainly the phenomenon of emotional harm caused by the war was there. It's just that it was handled much differently, often ignored or just treated in a very different fashion. But now, as we know, we even have the VA has a National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress, and the VA's website has a lot of very useful information on that. And we talk about some of these programs every week, Rick, like the VA's Coaching into Care program to try to help family members encourage their veteran to get the needed assistance, help, if you will. And I think that's an important thing to mention this month, although we do every week on our show. Mm-hmm. And something related to that, what I wanted to mention, something that we've addressed in some of the prior programs has been the issue of veteran suicide. You have numbers that kick around of, 20, 22 veterans take their lives and every day, and that something more needs to be done about it, despite the VA's existing programs. In an item of news that the VA addressed this past week, the VA and the White House apparently have an initiative they discussed in a press release from last Monday, June 17th, to try to address the issue of veteran suicide. And the VA Secretary Robert Wilkie and the Director of White House Domestic Policy Council, Joe Grogan, they've launched a cabinet-level task force to try to develop a nationwide roadmap. And, the government being the government, you can't start a program without a good acronym. And so they came up with an acronym that both captured the purpose of the program, but also seems to have a standalone meaning to it. And their acronym is the word PREVENTS. And that stands for the President's Roadmap to Empower Veterans and End the National Tragedy of Suicides. That's got to be one of the longest acronyms that I've encountered, and I was in the military, for 20 years. So I'm not trying to sound facetious or sarcastic about it, but I'm just pointing out that they've started this task force. It's got a name to it now. PREVENTS is the acronym. And, you give a bureaucracy a mission, and their first idea is to come up with a plan, Well, their efforts apparently is to develop a roadmap, and sometime next March of 2020, you know, many months away from now, they're going to deliver that plan to the White House. So I'm not sure what that tells you about a sense of urgency. It doesn't seem particularly urgent to me. But then again, I'm not in charge up there. But we'll see. We'll follow that issue as we follow it every month. But anyway, that's all I have for right now. Rick, over to you.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting stuff with that PREVENT program. You know, that one of the things that I always wonder about, you know, they say 22 suicides a day. And I don't think that takes into consideration the number of veterans who are suffering with mental issues, who are drinking themselves or drugging themselves to death. I think those deaths get put into a different category than quote unquote the suicides. But those are slow suicides as well. And I've seen that. I've seen those slow suicides, and they're as bad as if they had picked up a gun and pulled the trigger. So I personally think that the 22 is a low number. And, you know, there are a lot of programs out there through the VA, but there are also a lot of private programs. And, you know, there's just not enough programs. I mean, someone not too long ago asked me one day if weren't there just enough. And I said, let me tell you something. There's not enough. Because there are so many veterans who need the help and don't want to go to the VA because they've just got a bad taste in their mouth because the VA treated them so poorly over the years. So they need to find some sort of support for them. So we need all these little programs all over the country that are out there helping vets. So, David, why don't you give us some more news?
Okay.
Or talk to us about the cost of war projects. There's some other projects.
Yeah, we've talked about our cost of war and peace building project in the past, and our first film, which is an overview film, was released about 3 weeks ago. It's available on the website stopwar.today, also the Facebook page. If you search on the Facebook engine for Stop War Today, it's about a 24-minute film. Gives you an overview. It's highlighting the work of the Cost of War Project of Brown University, which is basically aiming to inform people and decision makers in government about the whole scope, the full spectrum of cost of war. And the costs are simply far beyond just economic costs, but the human costs both for those in the service but also civilians, both directly in combat but also those that lose their lives or that are injured or suffer because of the indirect effects of war, often as far as economic effects, but also because they become displaced from their homes, they become refugees seeking safety in other countries. So it's about a 24-minute film, just give an overview of the cost of the post-9/11 wars, and then also emphasizing the importance, the value of a new way of thinking. Of, you know, we invest so much in war, why don't we try to invest without weakening our country in any way, but let's see how we can invest in peace building. And one thing that I'm pleased with is that in our film, not to tip away the whole thing because I want people to watch it, is be sure to look for the special guest that both begins the film and ends the film, offering, I think, is some wonderful insights that are still valid today and certainly in the historical context when they were first delivered, something that I think didn't receive enough attention. But the program is also designed to inform people about a couple specific things. The United States Institute of Peace, their website is usip.org. It's a small, congressionally funded entity. Only about 300 people work for it. Their budget is less than $38 million a year. $38 million a year is a lot to me and most people I know, but when you're talking about an organization that's supposed to have a national and international impact, that's paltry money, particularly when you're talking about, you know, the defense budget of over $700 billion a year. $38 million is like comparing $38 to $700,000 if you were just knock off some zeros, just for ease of understanding. But in any event, check out the film. Website is stopwar.today. You can also find it on Facebook, search Stop War Today, or on YouTube, you can search for Stop War Today and include the word overview, and you'll find that overview film. So check it out. It'll be the first of hopefully a series of films, but the program is far beyond just films. It's an educational thing, and part of that is to inform people of the great work done by other individuals and organizations. And I'll make a quick pitch before I turn it over to Rick again, which is a book I find is excellent on the subject is Kathy Beckwith's book. It's called A Mighty Case Against War. If anyone wants a free copy of that, please send me their address. Send me an email. My email is lawcorey1@verizon.net. That's LAWCORY, the number 1@verizon.net. And if that was too fast for you, I'll repeat it one more time. My email is lawcorey1@verizon.net. You can also find that on our bbsradio.com/theveteransnewshour. You can find our contact information, my contact information, Rick Hurley. So send me an email. I'll send you a free copy of that book. It's called A Mighty Case Against War. Excellent book. Back over to you, Rick.
Thanks, David. Thank you for all that information. Yeah, that's great work on that documentary. And before we close the show tonight, I want to remind everybody about the Coaching Into Care program. We do it every week, ending our show, and it's a very important part of our show. This program helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help you help your veteran. Program's number is toll-free, 1-800-1888-823-7458. Hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the Coaching and the Care number is 1-888-823-7458. If anyone is out there who knows a family that could use the Coaching and the Care program, and you're listening to us tonight, give them this number and say, hey, maybe people want to call the Coaching and the Care program. One more time, 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to remind listeners that there is a crisis in the United States regarding veteran suicide, and the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. The number there is 1-800-273-8255, and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they needed. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problems. Once again, that number is at the Veterans Crisis Line is 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Again, 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Over to you, David.
Thanks. We're about running out of time, so thanks for listening. Tune in next week, same time, same station for the Veterans News Hour. Until then, have a great week. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on bbsradio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.